there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. Welcome to episode number 243. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send that email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. Every now and then we use it. Our handle is This Show Is So Gay. And of course, go to the Facebook, like us, because we sure as heck like you. So much ground to cover, we must get started. But a little bit of an intro to this one. So here's the thing, if this is your first time listening to This Show Is So Gay, here's the thing with This Show Is So Gay, that you all listen to this show is just an added bonus to this incredible opportunity that I have to speak with inspiring LGBT and ally folks using their voices in amazing ways. That was my goal when I started this show 5+ years ago, and it's been just a dream come true. What I never could have anticipated was that there would be guests who I would have on multiple times with whom I get to create an actual relationship because they are so generous in talking about their lives both to me and, of course, by extension to you. One of those special individuals is this week's first guest. Netta Ulaby reports on arts, entertainment, and cultural trends for NPR's Arts Desk. Her stories have included a series on women record producers, an investigation into exhibitions of plastinated human bodies, and a look at the legacy of our hero, gay activist Harvey Milk. Her profiles have brought listeners into the worlds of such performers as Tyler Perry, Ryan Seacrest, and Courtney Love. She has earned multiple fellowships at the Getty Arts Journalism Program at USC Annenberg, as well as a fellowship at the Knight Center for Specialized Journalism to study youth culture. In addition, her weekly podcast of NPR's Best Art Stories, Culturetopia, won a Gracie Award from the Alliance for Women in Media Foundation. She is, without question, one of my favorite people on this planet to speak with. Netta Ulaby, welcome back to This Show So Gay.
I am just blushing here on the episode 243.
I know. You know, and I had a little bit of anxiety about even mentioning the episode number because in our way distant past, you were not happy that you were not on episode 50.
I'm not happy I wasn't on episode 1. Are you kidding?
Yeah, because we knew what we were doing then. Come on.
I just wanted to be your first, Ken.
I'm not even going to touch that. I'm going to move on because we have so much ground. Are you even ready for how much ground we have to cover, you and I?
I don't know yet. Well, I don't know yet, but my running shoes are on. My
we'll find
sweat
out.
Pants are on.
We'll
I
find
am
out.
Full lesbian attire, and I am ready to go.
I'm now overwhelmed. We have I created one of those top 10 lists just for you. It's a lot. There's going to be a lot happening. But we'll do a little Netta Ulaby, This Is Your Life, because I was listening to your past appearances. This is your fifth time on our show. And you're laughing at it's your fifth time on our show?
Wow. We've both gotten so old, Ken.
Wow, I was feeling really good about that. Then you just kind of bracketed in that way, and not so great now. But and we are very traditionally have you on this time of year, this kind of end of the year thing. But I was listening to your past appearances, and we haven't done a ton of Netta Ulaby, This Is Your Life. So we got to get to some of that.
All right. I'm busy already, though, just sort of thinking about myself in this time of year. It's kind of like with the old Jell-O molds and the leftover turkey in the refrigerator where everyone opens the refrigerator. They're like, oh, God, not that. And maybe and that may be the place that I occupy on The Show Is So Gay.
No, do you know I only have really one true association with you in this time of year? You do know what it is, right?
Mm-mm.
It's you and Prince Caspian. That was your first time on this show. You were watching Prince Caspian, and you found him rather dreamy, and it was a little hard to tear you away from that.
No, that's right. Well, you know what? All I can say is that I've forgotten all about Prince Caspian, but I remember you very, very well.
Well, that's a good thing. That's a good thing. All right, so Netta Ulaby, born in Jordan, and then you did that classic and oh-so-cliched migration from Jordan to Kansas.
There were some stops in between, but yes. We went actually from Jordan to Beirut to Paris to Kansas, because that's even more cliched.
Oh, yeah.
Who doesn't do that?
Everybody Paris, not Kansas, named Ulaby.
You know. Right.
And what can you tell us about life in the Midwest? Because I get the sense you spent the bulk of your time there in the Midwest.
I did. I am a dyed-in-the-wool Midwesterner. That is what I am. I grew up in Lawrence, Kansas, and we moved to Ann Arbor, Michigan when I was 12. Two very different parts of the Midwest, yet also somehow similar in that they are both Midwest. And then I went to grad school in Chicago, the capital of the Midwest. And if I could live anywhere, to be honest with you, it would be the Midwest. My East Coast girlfriend is horrified by that. She's like, what about Beirut? What about Paris? What about Vegas? Someplace. I don't know what she thinks. But, you know, when I dream about retiring to Chicago or Lawrence, Kansas, she thinks I'm completely nuts. But it's home to me.
Wow. Now, I am, since the last time we chatted, I am now living – I almost said I am a Midwesterner. I don't know that I'm ever going to be able to say that. I now live in the Midwest. What do I need to know as a gay guy living in the Midwest?
Well, see, you live in Ohio.
Okay.
Right? And I did grow up in Michigan, and there is some tribalness there. And I just – I feel like people from Ohio listening to a Michigan girl tell an Ohio guy how to live – I don't think that would go over very well.
Yes, I was reading some story where the governor of Ohio, not that long ago, right before the big game, wanted to eliminate all M's from something or other. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, ridiculous tribalism is not something limited to the Midwest, sadly. But all I can say is this. You are, remind me where in Ohio you are.
I'm in Cleveland.
Which I don't know very well.
Me neither.
It was pretty close. And there was a lot that I really enjoyed about Cleveland, for example. The Mud Hens, which was the baseball team, the semi-professional baseball team. I mean, how can you not cheer for the Mud Hens? I can tell you what to do if you find yourself in Lawrence or Ann Arbor. Those are great places.
All right.
But, and this isn't something I've told a lot of people, we live down the street from William S. Burroughs.
Look at that.
The creepy old man on our street was actually America's creepy old man down the street. And it was literally one of those things where, you know, if you kicked your ball into Mr. Burroughs' yard, you did not go up to that door and knock and say, can I please have my ball back?
Wow. Asking for a cup of sugar would be epic.
Yeah, you know, who knows what you would get? Who knows what you would get? But I didn't actually realize, a little bit to my embarrassment, until I was in college. You know, he's obviously this big cult figure, and people would say, oh, William S. Burroughs, blah, blah, blah. And I feel like, really? You know him too?
There's one of him on every block.
You know, evidently. Evidently.
That is brilliant. That's brilliant. All right, so you went the journalism route. When was that point where you made that conscious decision, this is just so for me, this is the route I'm going to go?
Well, it was in the Midwest, where all good things happen. I was living in Topeka, Kansas. Which, by the way, has an absolutely, like, it's indescribably great gay community. Or it did when I was living there in the early 1990s.
Okay.
But, you know, probably could say, like, everybody kind of had to go there. If you were a gay farmer, you had to go to Topeka. If you were a service person who was in one of the many military bases around there, you had to go to Topeka. If you were a college student or a college professor at University of Kansas, which was about half an hour away, you had to go to Topeka because there were no gay bars in Lawrence, Kansas. You just went to William S. Burroughs. You had to go. And so Topeka had, like, the best gay bars I've ever been to because everybody had to go. Like, old people, white people, black people, Latino migrant workers were there, like, you know, every class, men, women, you know, and there would be all of these crazy alliances that would develop that would never happen otherwise. You would find, like, some old lady who was really tight with some drag queen.
Love it.
Because they would both just go there, and they would just, you know, in some weird alchemy, they would hit it off. And then when the drag queen got into a fight with some cop, some off-duty gay cop, there'd be some old lesbian, like, rising to his defense. It would be the scenes at that gay bar. There were quite a few in Topeka, actually. There were, like, five when I was there.
Okay.
But the main one, Expressions, was the best. It's my favorite gay bar I've ever been to. Any place, and that counts in Paris, in Berlin, in, like, any number of places. Expressions in Topeka was epic. It was great. I got there, and I was, I went to college on the East Coast, and
yeah.
Not many people were moving to Topeka, Kansas after that, and I was working for the Topeka Capital Journal as a journalist, as a very, very baby reporter. I think cub used to be the word that they would call it, but that just sounds weird in a gay context. And I was looking for a group of lesbians to hang out with, and I found one, and they were old lesbians. Like, I went to their meeting, and I don't even remember how I learned about them, but it was probably through an old, like, gay flyer that I picked up at Expressions. And there's not a single woman in this group who is under the age of 65 or 70.
Wow.
And one of the great regrets I'm going to carry with me to my grave, that as a callow 21-year-old, I ran screaming from that group, and I did not instead hang out with those women and document their stories and listen to what They were. I remember one of them told me that she was the first female postmaster of Kansas. I mean, this could have been, you know, my dissertation.
Wow.
And I was just like, oh, they're not hot. And I mean, it wasn't quite that. It's just, I wasn't quite that superficial. But, you know, I was really looking for peers, you know, and I just didn't quite have it. I just didn't quite have the stuff. I wasn't disciplined enough to sit down with these old ladies in a tape recorder and be like, tell me your stories, which I really should have done.
And it turns out she was endorsed by the Victory Fund.
Man, these ladies were like, they were so strong, the Victory Fund wouldn't even have known what to do with them.
By the way, I'm looking it up as we talk. I cannot find evidence that Expressions is still there.
I doubt it is. You know, I'm sure it went up in a blaze of, like, drugs and, you know, and drama probably 5 or 10 years after I left Topeka.
Yeah, our crack research team is on it right now, but that's mostly me just Googling, so I don't see it.
The Google hamsters.
Exactly, exactly. What about radio? We got to talk about radio, because radio just exists in this, I actually think it just exists in such a unique place in our culture, and it could have existed in this place that died out, particularly with new media and, or honestly, even with television. But radio, we still subscribe to the theory that radio is such a strong media, right?
Oh, do we? I don't know. Do we?
I'm going with you. I'm going with your opinion.
I don't know. I think it depends on how old you are. I think
okay.
It depends on where you live. You know, I think if you live in Southern California and you're stuck in your car and there's a great public radio culture. I don't know a lot about radio culture except for public radio culture, sadly. Like, then it's really vibrant and really cool. I think if you're 17 years old and most of what you've got to listen to on the radio really isn't very interesting, and you have your iPod and you can, like, listen to stuff from all over the world or whatever music you want, like, what is radio? Radio is kind of meaningless. I don't know. What do you think?
I've never really existed in a car-driven culture, mm-hmm. Just because Vermont, you're not supposed to. Well, Vermont, I guess, has the whole.
You do spend, I think, a fair amount of time in your car in Vermont, right?
Like, a little bit. A little bit.
Thinking about Vermont, everyone's such an environmentalist, but at the same time, like, you have to drive every place, like, actually pretty far distance.
Yeah, you have to drive every place, but you're never supposed to drive by yourself because we're supposed to be a community, and then you can't turn on the radio.
You take your goat with you.
Exactly. So, and then you have to take someone else in the car with you, and naturally, you can't listen to the radio. You got to talk about, yeah, no, I love soy, too. So it's a thing. It's a thing. What did you crochet? Oh, me too. So, but at the same time, just the ability of voice to get things across and to transmit. I've been reading a lot of books about radio lately and just have been really inspired by, yes, we're not the culture anymore that sits around the radio and has that as our campfire, but I still think it exists in that place.
I want to read these books.
Oh, I will send you a list. I
think you should post them because presumably other people are listening to our conversation and they might want to know too.
I will do that.
Because they're probably people who care about people talking and listening to people talking.
There's just something so genuine and pure about voice and voice's ability to do that storytelling. I rather enjoy it and thus keep doing it. What do you remember about your first time on the radio?
It would have been better with you. That's another regret, Ken. That's one of my many. What do I remember? I don't, you know, I don't know about you. Like, my first time, it was a little indistinct. Like, the first time I was ever on the radio, I was working as a film critic in Chicago for the gay newspaper.
Okay.
And there was a gay radio show.
Nice.
I don't remember what it was called. It wasn't The Show Is So Gay, but it could have been.
It could have been.
And they called me once a week, and we did a movie review show, me and another guy.
Okay.
And that was it. And it didn't feel very, it lacked the glamour of, you know, sort of swanning into a studio and fancy microphones and, you know, stuff on the walls that absorbed sound. It was just, you know, sitting in my living room chatting with really charming people. Something I've doing right now. In fact, then I did like some training stuff, and it was a long time before I was actually like had the experience of walking into a studio and doing a radio story. And by the time that happened, I don't know, I don't even know how to describe it, Ken, because I'd been doing so many things kind of on the margins of that world for so long, and working as kind of an assistant in that world and helping other people that. And also trying, I don't know, there's a part of me that where I almost, I almost couldn't believe it was happening, so I almost pretended like it wasn't. I was busy pretending like it was completely normal and that I wasn't intimidating. It's one of those, like, fake it till you make it kind of moments.
Oh, I know it. I do it all the time.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, I think that the proper answer would have been, well, I fell on my knees and I kissed the ground of the studio. And in my heart, that is how I felt. But I was having a lot of emotions and a lot of feelings, but the primary one was fear. Please
yeah.
don't let me mess this up.
Yeah, I have a gay radio show, so the question's probably a little bit more explicit and overt and easier for me, but you cover just such a wide range of material, and we're going to talk about that in a second. How do you think the being gay piece plays into how you use your voice in the stories you cover?
You know, I did an interview one time with a gay publication, and I said something a little politically incorrect, and they didn't use it, which is that I think it's a bigger deal for guys than for women.
Okay.
You know, women, there's never, when you think of the most awful, hateful, stereotypical ways that gay men are mocked, one way is through how they talk.
Right.
You know, and I think gay men are conscious of that, and they're careful about it. And I have such empathy towards that. Whereas women, it can almost be a relief. You know, you're not being judged by how you look. And women are so, whether they're, you know, my super butch girlfriend, well, I think she'd object to being called super butch, but my soft butch girlfriend would, even though we occupy different points on the sort of gender lady spectrum, we're used to being assessed how we look all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I don't like about the internet is that people can Google me and they can see what I look like. It's something that I've always found so wonderful and intriguing about radio is you don't know. You
right.
have no idea. And you hear these voices and you have a picture in your head. And you know, I've gotten very used, like I think most people who work in radio, to meeting people and having their faces drop when they meet me. And it's not even because I'm that hideous. I think it's more just because they have a picture in their head of what I look like and I don't match it.
It's funny. There's this maybe 40-second YouTube clip of you talking about going to the dog park.
Oh, God. That's, yeah.
And getting lost in your iPad, maybe?
Yeah.
Something like that. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, none of the comments, because I'm one of those idiots who read the comments.
Oh, I never read the comments.
Yeah, no, and you're just
right
for doing
that.
Yes,
yes, yes.
That is the correct answer. But
yes.
The comments are all about matching face to voice. Nothing about the content. It's never about the content. It's like, wait a second, this voice actually has a face, and that's weird for me.
What they don't match it then to is, this is also a human being who might read the comments.
Right.
The comments. But that's okay.
That's okay.
That's all right.
Now, I have to ask, are the NPR gays doing okay? I would imagine that you all are in still a little bit of a state of shock that our Ari Shapiro is moving across the pond.
Yeah, we're sitting gay Shiva. Yeah. Yeah, that is, yeah.
We'll just move on from that.
But I have to tell you, we have, you know, Ari is obviously kind of a super gay and a superhuman and is amazing in countless levels, but we have a lot of awesome gay people at NPR. You know, I think the spotlight needs to be trained on Sonari Glinton.
Okay.
Amazing. Zoe Chace. Amazing. Like, these are two people who I think are incredible. Jeff Brady. Awesome, incredible reporter. There's so many gay people at NPR.
Netta, I want them all on my show, so get them all for me.
You have to have them all. I will personally deliver them all to you.
Let's be clear. Let's see how our relationship started. And by the way, our relationship, so much stronger than Ari and I's relationship, just want to put that out there, it was having Ari on the show and Ari saying exactly what you're saying. Look, there are all these amazing people like Netta Ulaby. And I said, well, then I want her on my show. And thus we were born.
Well, you know, at the minute you talk to Sonari and Zoe, I will be forgotten.
I just doubt it.
They're both spectacular.
Because the other thing was, this is, by the way, one of the most hilarious things that I was reading about you on the internet, and there are so many, and we'll get to a ton of them.
Are you going to read the comments?
No, I'm staying away from the comments.
Your voice sounds.
I moved here to Cleveland and went and got my new license plates, and they offer you the option of getting a personalized license plate. Should I have wanted to be an original and get a license plate that somehow evokes your last name, I was reading in the Atlantic that would not be original at all.
Yeah, you know, I have to say I'm really lucky. It's a little weird when you have a name that people think of as unusual, because I don't know, they just sort of fixate on that. I'm sure if I read the comments, there'd be other things they'd fixate on. But in terms of what I get, you know, there's a lot of you have such an unusual last name. And you know, and the thing is, they're absolutely correct. It is unusual, even in the Arab world. It's a very unusual last name. And partly because my somewhat eccentric father chose to spell it in a very idiosyncratic way. We're the only members of our family who spell it this way.
Okay.
And partly because, well, it's all complicated, but he decided to spell it this way, and I love the spelling, actually. I think it's great. But people are always, they make such a big deal about it. Oh, people at NPR, they have such unusual names. And what I always say, Ken, is tell me the names of your coworkers. And after about four or five names, they're always like, oh, I mean, what are the names of your coworkers?
Well, let's just go with my own. I recently learned through my students that my name, Ken Schneck, is an auditory palindrome.
In what way?
Apparently, it's the same forwards and backwards. Listeners,
God.
You can do this in the privacy of your homes or out in the car.
God.
I know, it's very exciting.
Say it again and say it backwards.
It Ken Schneck, and if you reverse it, it's Ken Schneck.
Oh, my God.
I know, it's revelatory here for the new year.
I'm having chills. That is the coolest.
I know.
My sister's name is a palindrome, the way you spell it, Aziza, A-Z-I-Z-A.
There you go.
But it's certainly not, maybe it is the way you say it, too, but like an entire front and last name, a first and last name.
Pretty good.
That is very cool.
But wait, to complete the story, because I love this. You were invited to just some random listeners, or you knew them, their wedding?
Oh, God, no, I did not know them. There were, I'm sure they're incredibly lovely people, but you know, a lot of couples, I think, who are hardcore NPR listeners have this, you know, kind of little game where you say to each other, oh, blah, 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 for NPR News or whatever. I have these friends who play a game where it just sounds so silly when you say it, but they like, you know, they say, Ophelia Quistarton, Ari Shapiro, Jeff Brady, Starry Glenn. And they do it back and forth, and the person who wins is the person who can think of the last name. So anyway, this couple they just kind of gotten into, they liked my crazy little name, and they started calling each other my little Ulibi.
Oh my.
And so I became their mating call, and it apparently became important enough in their relationship that they decided to send me a wedding invitation when they got married. And it was quite touching. It was a little creepy.
A little bit.
They sent me a picture of their license plate. Had, it was O-O-O-O, like L-A-A-A-B-E-E-E.
Oh, my gosh.
It was cute. It was very cute.
Now, I have to ask, and I feel this is a significant question, what kind of car was it?
Oh, I didn't even notice.
Oh, I feel that there was, that's a detail of the story that even says more, but I'm not sure.
It was probably, a Subaru or a Honda Civic.
That was my assumption.
Like, I'm guessing it was one of those, but I do not remember.
Well, before we get to what, it's a top five list that I put together for you. I have to tell you, you had, and this is, I'm sure other people enjoyed it, and I know that they did, but for me, it was the best Facebook status update of 2013. And I don't say that lightly. Do you have a sense?
Was it like my mom picking on me?
Oh, that was funny, too. The part where you said, oh, look, I'm a ragamuffin. And she said, no, you're more like a hobo. So that was very cute. But no, this is, and I quote from Netta Ulaby, it's a special tiny slice of hell when not only do you do a terrible interview, but then you have to sit at your desk and listen back to it.
Right.
That's a fun part of our jobs, isn't it?
You know, and it's a salvage operation that just makes you feel like it doesn't make you feel very good when you're doing it. It's
Now, what I do when because with some
what do you do
with some frequency? No, this is not a tip. This isn't helpful at all. I'm curious if you then have to take just crazy amounts of breaks as well when you're editing the horrible stuff. Because when I do a bad interview, and I know, and this is not one of them, so don't walk away thinking this is a bad one, it's a good one. But when I walk away and it's a terrible one, I dread editing it, and it takes me exponentially longer because I have to keep taking breaks because I'm so disgusted.
Yeah, and my problem with that is when I take those breaks, I have this fantasy. I think that when I come back, somehow it's going to be good, and it's, you know, and I'm just greeted with a steaming pile of awful interview that I left, and things aren't better. They're even worse than
you
I
plow
remember.
Through. You plow through. That's a good thing.
This is why deadlines are good, right? Because you just have to, like, muscle through them.
You got to do them.
And, yeah.
You got to do them. All right, well, it's that time of year, Ned Olby, and I know you've seen, and NPR's got a ton of top five and top ten lists, and I'm thinking, well, I want my own list, but I want one that nobody else has done. I can't do, like, the top five books and things like that because everybody else has done that. So what I did was I put together for you Netta Ulaby's top five gayest stories of 2013.
Oh, wow.
This is very exciting. So I want to get your take on some of these. And like all top five lists, this is extraordinarily subjective. So some of them not so gay, but I had to go with something. You ready?
Yes.
Number five. And again, this might be one of those that I feel is a gay story, but maybe not so much. Number five, and I enjoyed this one, Winona Ryder. It was about Winona Ryder.
Yeah, in some ways, that was kind of a gay story, wasn't it? And it's funny you say so, because there's in many ways, there's nothing gay about that story except for that really gay guy who's in that story.
Yes.
So he's talking about the whole shoplifting scandal, and he was – do you remember what he said? He gayed up the whole story. He says, first of all, when Winona Ryder was in the movie Girl Interrupted with Angelina Jolie, who at the time was a total unknown, that was Angelina Jolie's big break. She got a Best Actress, Best Supporting Actress nomination, and all you can see is the fear in Winona's eyes as Angelina Jolie steals the entire movie away from her.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like this Betty Davis, Joan Crawford.
Totally.
Smackdown.
Totally.
And then he's like, oh, and this guy, by the way, his name is James Patrick Herman, and he is brilliant, and you should interview him at some point.
Okay.
He's had many interesting jobs in the media industry, and right now he's running a magazine out of L.A. But then at some point he says something like, oh, and then she shoplifted all these Marc Jacobs clothes. Who wouldn't want to shoplift Marc Jacobs clothes? It was the cutest scandal ever. Of course she shoplifted his clothes.
Well, but you had a moment in there too, though. You definitely, you had an attitude line that I loved. And I'm probably not getting this word for word, but it was quite laden with meaning when you said Winona's agents ignored our requests for interviews.
I know. I was so irritated by that because, you know, I mean, for me, Winona was never like a love object, but she stood for outsiders.
Right.
You know, she stood for people who felt different, who didn't quite fit in. I talked to this straight African-American film critic who said, you know, every single one of us who didn't quite belong in the mainstream identified with Winona Ryder. And I just love that you know, African-Americans,
yeah,
gays, you know, men, women, we all, Winona was one of us, you know. She really was an important character for many of us in the 1990s. And I would, I would be really, really happy if her comeback, you know, was really decisive and triumphant.
Right.
And I rewatched Heathers recently. Have you rewatched that movie recently?
As in, I watch it every couple of weeks, yes.
Oh, my God. It is such a – I hadn't watched it, Ken, in years.
Oh, really? Every couple weeks.
It was a billion times better than I remembered. And there's never been a movie that she was as good in. Beetlejuice, maybe. She nailed that movie.
Anytime I'm done with a conversation, I just have the temptation, and I don't, to say, great Pate, but I got a motor if I'm going to be on time. You know, it's just – it comes up. I love Heather. That'll be thing. Okay, that was the number five story. By the way, you could have said Winona's agents did not get back to us at press time, but no, it was Winona's agents ignored our request for interviews.
They completely ignored our
request. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. There you go. The number four story, girls' Legos are a hit, but why do girls need special Legos?
Wait, was this one keeping you up at night?
A little bit. So there's that one. Because that was a lot like the pen, the special pen for women, which I enjoy that.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So that was number four. Number three. And because we've been talking about this a lot, more this year than any other year of the show. Number three, Netflix to stream original series based on Marvel characters. The gays love the Marvel characters, Netta.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Men?
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Women?
No, the women, absolutely. Women and Wonder Woman, that's like a whole thing. But men and the mass superheroes, because this was the year that really the comic book stuff took off, particularly in the gay community, because it was the two gay guys who led the whole protest against Ender's Game, the Harrison Ford.
And but that's different. I mean, that's not a comic.
Oh, no, it was a comic book organization called Geeks Out that led that protest.
Which, and they tried so hard
to
make that work for the gays, right? They hired, what's his name, the cute screenwriter, Dustin
Lance Black, yeah.
Yeah, they hired him, and they really tried to make it work.
They tried.
I didn't see it. Did you see it?
No, I never saw
it. And I love the book. I really, really love that book.
Yeah. That whole thing between content and author, it's hard to separate those things.
I mean, I don't know about you. Did you read the book?
I did read the book, yes.
Do you like the book?
I grew up on sci-fi and fantasy as escapism, so it didn't hold up to my, you know, Terry Brooks, kind of David Eddings kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, it's very different from Terry Brooks, isn't it? It's, you know, it's much harsher, you know, and it's... And Ender's Game there's a harshness to it that I think I kind of like.
I was trying to escape from that, Netta.
Yeah, understood. Yeah, I was just refracting it. I definitely read Ender's Game before I knew about Orson Scott Card's very hardcore beliefs.
Oh my gosh,
to issues like gay marriage, I don't know. I mean, but so many of those guys, right? Like Heinlein, you know?
Right.
It's not like Heinlein never had the opportunity to opine on gay marriage, but I can't imagine it would have been. And even, you know, someone like, you know, my beloved Ray Bradbury.
Yeah.
He's
had some comments.
Yeah.
By the way, so has Terry Brooks. I mean, Terry Brooks has come under fire too for, look how many books you have. Can you throw in a gay character somewhere in the books? And he's been pretty resistant to that. So
I don't know how you feel about this. I mean, I don't know if people should throw in gay characters if they don't feel them. You know,
right.
they're creators. They should express the worlds that they feel. And it's not we have such wonderful worlds. You know, with queer science fiction writers like, you know, Samuel Delaney. You know, Octavia Butler. You know, there's a lot of like really rich stuff out there without people. Without us feeling like we have to strong arm, you know,
people who don't want to.
You know what I mean? I want to enter the worlds that they have in their heads, not try to bend their world.
But I get weird about it, and this kind of it actually leads us right to your number two gayest story of 2013, because I've become obsessed with. My recent obsession is with the TV show Parenthood. I have thrown myself into the show with a vigor that really defies explanation. And I was listening to your story about the TV show The Fosters, which I didn't know.
Yeah, that was a very, yes. Right.
I didn't know a ton about.
I thought that was the number one show that you would have put on your list.
No. Are you kidding? No. We'll get to my number one is.
Even gayer?
Yeah, oh, you got so much gayer. We'll get to that. But you know, this whole idea of, as you covered, there are shows out there with gay characters on there that we don't have to force upon the creators. Whereas I sit and I watch Parenthood, and my sister's way ahead of me. She's more current on what's happening. And as I've said to her, is there going to be a gay character at some point? Because it strikes me somewhere in here there should be a gay character, and I actually get frustrated that there's not.
I gotta tell you, I can watch a lot of stuff and not necessarily miss the gay character.
Yeah.
But I think it's also because I think like every other gay person, I'm used to subtext.
Right.
You know, and I don't need it spelled out. And sometimes it's almost more delicious if it's subtext. Do you know what I mean?
I think my deal is, though, I think knowing – maybe it's less for me and knowing maybe even in this context that my family's watching it. And so it would be really great for there to be another entry point for them and all the other people watching Parenthood.
And I'm not a Parenthood watcher, so – you know, I can't speak to that. But you're right. I mean, when I think about the shows that I watch on TV, now that I'm thinking about it, there's not a lot of gay characters. Like, my girlfriend is obsessed with Nashville. Are there gay characters on Nashville, do you know?
I only watched the first episode. But yes, my sister has said that there are because she watches that as well.
Which is just like real Nashville,
where
one of the most powerful songwriters is a gay guy. Or Brandi Clark, who's a lesbian. But let's go back to your list, Tom. Here I am. I'm leading you astray.
Well, it actually brings us to our number one story. The number one story, which you cut it very close, and I need to go back and listen to.
Wait, didn't we miss like 3, 2?
Yeah, we skipped those. Okay. Well, it was about the Fosters.
I wouldn't know what they were. I wouldn't know what lies in between the Fosters and whatever number one is.
Well, the Fosters was number two. That was – so people should go watch The Fosters. I've never seen it. I don't even know if it's still on. Is it still on?
It's still on.
Okay, good. So we should go watch that. And it was the Marvel characters were number three, and that's got a whole gay subtext. And then number one, I think you finished your interview with me last year at the end of the year, and then I don't even know if you mentioned you were just about to do a story called Who's Gay on TV, Dads, Journalists, Investigators, and Footmen. That was far and away your gayest story of 2013.
Yes, that was quite a gay story. That might have been the gayest story I've ever done.
Look, and how did that make you feel?
When you are a gay journalist and you are reporting on gay things, it makes you feel a combination of things. First of all, it's something that I think you pay a little bit more attention to than other people.
Right.
So you're like, oh, I know this. On the other hand, if you've also been targeted as a gay journalist by organizations that monitor this kind of thing, you're like, oh no, this is just going to be like delicious, you know, juicy meat for these folks who have gotten very, very, very angry when I have reported in the past on Bert and Ernie or, you know, the first ever exhibition of gay and lesbian art at the Smithsonian Institution. There are definitely people out there who think that the last people who should report on gay and lesbian art are gay and lesbians because they are very, very biased.
That kind of negates
and
my whole show.
By the same thinking, you know, obviously Christian people should not report on anything Christian.
Well, obviously.
And, you know, that you can extrapolate all day long.
Oh, man. Can I just say that you are one of those people I can just extrapolate with all day long?
Oh, honey, I like extrapolating with you.
Well, all of Netta Ulby's stories, you can find them all. I love that you could just go so far back and just listen to Netta all day long. You just go to npr.org. There's a link right to you, and all your stories are archived right there. And you don't have to read the comments if you don't want to.
Or you can. They might make you feel better.
Now, what are you working on next? What are we looking out for?
We're doing this big series about rhythm coming up, and I'm doing a story about art that is based on heartbeats.
Wow.
And this is gayish. I'm working on a story about fan fiction and how fan fiction helps to keep TV shows alive. Shows, for example, like Supernatural.
That is the one.
Right? So I need your feedback on this one. So like what comes to your mind?
Oh no, it's Supernatural and yeah. It's unbelievable that people have now what's your familiarity with the show?
I am gaining familiarity over the next couple weeks.
As someone who has done a Supernatural immersion,
yeah.
It's an actual program out of the Esalen Institute in Big Sur. It's not, but I've done it, and it's pretty close. It's amazing how much fan fiction reimagines these two brothers as lovers, and I don't know that it reimagines them, you know, not as brothers anymore, but mm-hmm. I actually don't think that it does. I think there's fan mm-hmm. fiction that keeps them as brothers and then lovers, which is problematic on a whole different level.
God. The people who are so mad at me about Bert and Ernie are going to go
nuts.
Extra banana town.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, but Buffy fan fiction, and people are still churning out the Battlestar Galactica fan fiction. The Supernatural, as someone who... I'm not going to lie, I'm quite the devotee. Mm-hmm. I have done some perusing of the fan fiction, and that's a whole world. Now, as I'm sure you know, they have done episodes about the fan fiction.
About the fan fiction.
It's so meta.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, it's fascinating. And the fan fiction is probably something that's helped keep it alive.
Yeah.
And this is what's so fun and so interesting is the interplay between, you know, the fans' narratives and the show's narratives and its success and... The show was really horribly rated for a long time. It was
the
fan engagement that was keeping it going.
Well, it's interesting. But that connects back to that whole idea of can we influence the creators to add content? I remember when Lost was in its heyday and added two characters that everyone hated and they were killed off within episodes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
So there you go. All right, so you got stories coming out that we're excited for. You have to be aware. It's one of my favorite episodes of the year when we get to have you on.
Oh. Oh, thank you. Oh, well, you say that now. You haven't yet talked to Zoe and Sonata.
I'm going to have this whole monthly segment of gay NPR people. I'm so excited.
You know, I think you could do a lot worse than Zoe and Sonata.
I'm ready. So,
cool.
Robin's doing well?
All's good with Robin.
Oh, great. We're going to elect more gay people?
We are. Gay people are doing pretty good, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. You had a brief turn covering, maybe I shouldn't say brief turn. It sounded like a brief turn when you talked about it last time. Covering politics. Is that something you would like to do more of?
Is that where my expertise is?
Right.
You know, my expertise is more in arts and cultural coverage. I always love pitching in and doing stories, you know, when they need, you know, more hands on deck. You know, inaugurations or elections or so forth. I really love that. But I cannot pretend that I am someone who is as incredibly our reporters who do politics have a really their knowledge of politics is unbelievably impressive and it would take a lot of study to catch up with them.
Yeah, well, you have enough to do and enough to keep us entertained as you do and pique our interest. And as I said at the top of the show, you are one of those folks using your voice, bringing our attention to topics that either we've not heard about and we should have, or what I love about what you do is you take these things that are right in front of us and you recast them in just this amazing light and make us pause and make us reconsider. And it's a beautiful gift.
Oh, thanks, Ken. Thank you.
Netta Oldby, please keep doing what you're doing.
Ken, backwards and forwards, the same. And by the way, what's the line about the pate and motoring?
Great pate, but I got a motor if I'm going to be on
pate.
Time.
Exactly. Great pate, but I got a motor.
Thanks, Netta.
Thank you, Ken. Take care.
And we are back with another incredible guest. Dana Goldberg is a comic, an actor, and a writer. She was voted one of the top 5 funniest lesbians in America. She's performed in clubs and theaters all over the country. She's been on the cover of magazines. She's produced some pretty darn incredible events that we're going to talk about. In her comedic and philanthropic work, Dana has shared the national stage with President Obama, Jane Lynch in the cast of Glee, Lady Gaga, Kathy Griffin, Portia de Rossi, our favorite Judy Gold, David Brenner, Kathy Najimy, and she will be performing as part of the Come Out Laughing Tour at the Wall Street Nightclub in Columbus, Ohio on January 25th. Dana Goldberg, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Ken, that was the best intro I've ever heard in my life. How are you?
I had to cut a lot out. I was going to say stuff about your mom. You know, we're not even there yet.
I love that. I was going to talk about your mom immediately. That's my mom's favorite when I talk about her on stage. How are you?
I'm doing really well. We have Jewish moms. Of course it's their favorite.
Oh, my gosh. She's so funny. I have very dirty jokes in my routine, and she came up to me after a show, and she goes, Dana. And I was like, oh, no. She said, I'm fine with the material. Did you have to say I was 63 on stage? That was it. That was the problem she had. Not the sex toys, not the jokes about, you know, a butt plug. It was the fact that I said she was 63.
We perhaps have different relationships with our respective mothers, Dana. It's possible. It's possible. Well, it brings us to our first question, where we always start with our funny people over the years, and I think you're giving us a glimpse into it. How would you describe where Dana Goldberg finds the humor?
Oh, I definitely, my life, I think, as every comic does, it's not really topical when it comes to, like, public affairs and, you know, public events and things like that. I get a lot of my material from my family and my relationships and also politics. So I guess in that sense, I do keep up on current affairs, but mainly it's personal. It's personal, but although, you know, when I'm on stage and people always ask, is that true? I'm like, some of it is and some of it's not.
That's not the point. Did you laugh? Exactly. Let's move on.
Exactly. Was it funny?
Talk to us about that decision. What was that moment of clarity where you said, I'm totally going on stage?
Oh, my God. The first time I did it, I was 17. And I decided, as one does, I'm going to do 10 minutes of stand-up in my senior talent show.
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah. So I was on stage, and I was telling jokes about my ex-boyfriends and why it wasn't working out so well. And I didn't remember this, Ken, until we found the tape and went to digitize it to put it on my DVD. I'm wearing a pair of jeans, a button-down, and a tie.
Huh.
Yeah, I looked a little like Paula Poundstone.
I was going to say it.
And the guy, this straight guy digitizing, looks at me and he goes, "You were straight?" And I was like, "I thought I was." He goes, "Oh, no. You couldn't have been gayer unless you were wearing a softball glove and a jersey."
The tape tells a different story.
Oh, good Lord. So I did that. And then, to be honest with you, I didn't touch a stage for about 8 years. I had a public speaking fried, and I would get really nervous and speak quickly. So in good lesbian form, I got a degree in physical education.
Of course.
The law. And after that, there was a show that used to come through Albuquerque, and it was called Funny Lesbians for a Change, and one of your future guests, Suzanne Westenhofer, was actually headlining it when I saw
Oh, wow.
It. And so I was a little bit, you know, earlier, mid-20s, and I was like, I want to do that. So I went and auditioned, and they gave me a 7-minute set, and they put me second in the show, and it wasn't like a little room. It was 650 people in a sold-out theater in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
I don't know if you know, that's actually a lot of people.
I had no idea it was going to feel like what it felt. I didn't touch the microphone because I felt like I was going to turn it into like a vibrating like amplifier. I didn't. It was horrible. Heartbeat through my shirt.
Wow.
But I'll tell you what, I hit my first big joke, and I heard the most deafening noise, deafening laughter I'd ever heard in my life, and I just went into a zone, and I was like, oh, this is what I'm supposed to do. In the past, I had auditioned for a couple of other things because I knew I wanted to be on stage.
Yeah.
I had auditioned for Stomp twice, and I've been a drummer since I was young, but that definitely wasn't my calling. But the first time I heard that laughter, I was like, oh, that's what they're talking about. And then everything just kind of took off from there.
Now, I don't want to harp on this point, but when you said you heard your heartbeat through your shirt, was it a button down and were you wearing a tie?
It was a button-down. I got rid of the tie.
Okay.
I figured I needed to do that. It was a tie that had polar bears on it, Ken. I was like, what the hell was I thinking? Yeah, you totally look straight, Dana. Absolutely.
With polar bears, it could have been dreidels, and that would have been a good story.
It could have been dreidels, and I won that talent show.
No, you didn't.
I did. I was the first time I ever got paid to do comedy. They gave me $100. I was like, all right, I'm addicted.
And cash, too. I was going to say they could have given you, like, Indigo Girls CDs or something like that.
They could have. Something.
It could have been. So that is fantastic. Now I have to ask, what was the moment when you told your mother, I'm committing to this?
I don't know if I ever had that moment where I was like, this is what I'm going to do. When I've always been funny. My kindergarten teacher told my mother I was the funniest 5-year-old she's ever had in her class. So I think this has just always been a part of me.
Yeah.
I never really had to, as a sense, come out as a comedian to my mom. You know, she encouraged what I do. She's one of my biggest fans, and I don't ever think there was a moment of, I'm not going to be a doctor, I'm not going to be a lawyer, but I am going to struggle for the rest of my life, and I'm going to do stand-up comedy, and you're going to be proud.
Do you perform differently when she's there?
No.
No?
No, don't change a thing. I actually don't change a thing when I'm performing in, you know, mainly straight crowds. I'll rearrange my material so that I don't come out, like, right away. But
right.
No, it's a big part of who I am, and my mom supports it. She loves, you know, I'm not the only gay child in the family.
Right.
So it's not like that's a big deal either.
And are there three of you? Did I get that right?
Yes. Older brother's gay, older sister's straight. As long as she acts gay in public, we don't have a problem with it.
I was going to say, it's got to be rough for her.
Yeah, she was born that way, though, Ken. I mean, it's not a phase. She's going to stay that way. We accept her.
It's very, you know, it's magnanimous of you.
I feel big about it. You know, I know what it feels like to be discriminated against. I don't want her to have to go through that.
Maybe just a little, though?
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay, just check it in.
Well, I have a joke in my routine that gets her every time, and she's like, can you please stop telling that? And I'm like, absolutely not. I'll never stop telling that tagline. I will not.
I love it. Now, I mentioned in the intro, you are doing this Coming Out Laughing Tour, and I said to you off the air, we have just a string of comics coming on in the next 6 weeks, culminating with Suzanne Westenhofer. So very exciting, and I love talking to gay comics because you guys use your voices in just the most incredible way. What does it mean to you to be part of an all-gay lineup?
Well, I think that for me, performing with two of my best friends also helps. Ian Harvey and Jason Duty are two of the funniest comics I've had the pleasure of putting a tour together with. Their voices are so different and so unique. And Ian's trans, and he's a very, very handsome trans man.
Oh, yeah.
I have a crush on, which is quite
me too.
Right? Ian has the entire world attracted to him. I'm like, well done, sir. Well done. And Jason is just he's just so funny on and off the stage, and the three of us together have such a wonderful rapport, and because our voice is so different, we bring three 3/4 of the LGBT community to the stage in one show.
Yeah.
You know, which is so powerful because it hits almost every demographic that's going to show up. And the bottom line is that we have a lot of straight audience members as well, because when you break down the barriers, Ken, you take down the gender and you get rid of the pronouns. Funny is funny, relationships are relationships, and families are crazy.
That's what it is.
Across the board.
That's what it is. Now, you said that you don't change your routine with gay or straight audiences. Do you prefer an audience?
Oh, I was.
Yes, I would like people.
I went on a long bike ride today in Palm Springs in the heat. It was a little warm, so I was like, is he going to finish that? I do prefer an audience. Can I prefer their people in there?
I went a little meta on that one. Sorry. It was a Mad Libs. I felt like that's where we were.
That was, you're like, and fill in the noun. I would like to choose straight. It depends, to be honest with you. I work with, I work with Olivia. So if you take that, it's all lesbians.
Oh, boy.
Sometimes that's hard because they have heard it, they have seen it, and they're sitting there with their arms crossed, and they're like, tell me something new. And they're such a wonderful crowd as well, though. They're very warm and welcoming. The gay community has supported me from the beginning of my career. So
yeah.
I feel at home. However, I get some of my biggest compliments from straight couples from 25 to 75 that will come up to me afterwards and say, you're one of the funniest comedians we've seen. I was performing up in Rhode Island, and I looked over, not kidding, everyone else in the audience you can tell is between 25 and 40. I look over, and there's kind of a throne chair, and it's a love seat, and there's two people that got to be 75. And I looked over at the manager before I went on stage, and I said, what is happening? They're like, I don't know, but they pushed their way to the front of the line.
Look at that.
And they cut in and got into the club. And I was like, okay. So I went up to him afterwards. I was like, kind of, what are you doing here kind of thing? Because it was just so surprising. And they're like, oh, we saw you on Groupon. We read the description. We loved you. We'll come back. You have two new fans. And I was like, fantastic.
I love your hesitation in asking them, because you're like, look, I see you and I validate you, but what are you doing here?
Yeah. Okay. And, I got all kinds of information. He is a top. They've never had a threesome. I got all kinds of information from the gentlemen during the show. They were so participatory. It was wonderful. I like the straight. It does not matter. I think sometimes it's even more fun to play in front of straight audiences because we give them permission to laugh at something taboo.
Right.
That's great. I can make a gay person laugh. Well, they can relate to me.
Right.
They know relationships and know what it feels like. The straight people really enjoy, when I say straight people, it almost sounds like they're animals. They come, we feed them. They really like, I think, to just be able to be in an atmosphere where it's okay to laugh at things that are funny.
Yeah.
And they're not being homophobic. They're not being hateful because we're laughing at the same thing.
Right. I must tell you, I did have my Dana Goldberg mortification moment where I was laughing to one of your bits because it was just so absurd. And then I realized, oh, crap, I did that. And it was about your spell as a vegetarian and your reasons for doing that.
Isn't that funny?
Tell everyone why you became a vegetarian.
I was codependent. Codependent. I stopped eating meat for 4 years because she didn't eat meat. And apparently I had too much energy and lean muscle mass. We broke up, Ken, and like 4 years later, I was like, wait a minute. I like chicken and turkey and being able to stand up quickly without passing out. And it's so funny because people are always like, that's not how vegetarians are. And I'm like, I'm kidding. It's comedy.
It's a joke.
I was a vegan once in between meals.
My problem is that I'm codependent and stubborn, so I became a vegetarian for the same reasons as you, and I'm still one, even though he's not anymore, and we're not together.
That's amazing.
So that's bad. And then I will say, as my listeners know, I was a vegan for a week, because a radio show guest years ago challenged me to be vegan for a week. I lost most of my friends because I was so mean for a week.
People with dietary issues, you can either be a complete outcast.
Oh, yeah.
Erin Foley has one of the funniest bits now about, because she's gluten intolerant. It's just amazing what it does, and the people you bond with, and you're like, wait a minute, no, I don't want to be part of this club.
Right.
Like, I didn't choose this.
Why are you so angry? Because I'm hungry. I don't know what I'm doing.
All the time. It's like Passover, 365 days a year. I need some carbohydrates.
There's a red X on the door. Just keep going. You don't want to talk to me right now. Trust me.
Oh, no.
Trust me. Now, yes, Aaron Foley will be on in a couple weeks, so that's exciting too. Now, you right there on the Facebook, there's a little bit of a public breakup that we all have to process together. It seems that you have broken up with the year 2013.
I have. I didn't... Oh, Ken, I'm so sorry. I wasn't prepared for this question. I didn't know you were going to ask.
I'll give you a second.
Okay.
Okay.
No, please. Okay.
We do this together. We're a family, Dana.
I feel so close to you. We've just met. Okay, I'm ready. I just need thank you for that. Thank you. I'm sorry for the listeners. I'm fine. I'm good.
We process together, and then we learn from each other.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry. 2013 was kind of a for the last 6 months of our relationship, so
yeah.
I was done.
Well, people have to check that out. It's very, I was laughing pretty hard there at your open letter to 2013 right there on your Facebook page. We do have to talk about your philanthropic efforts because this is huge and this is important. You started the annual Southwest Funny Fest in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I looked it up. New Mexico, totally one of the 50 states, which was, I did not know. It's in its seventh year in existence. It benefits the New Mexico AIDS Services. Why, Dana Goldberg, with your busy schedule, did you say, no, I need to spend time on this?
Twofold. One, Albuquerque is my home state.
Yeah.
I'm my home state. I'm very educated. I'm very pretty. Albuquerque is my home city. New Mexico is my home state. I'm not even drinking. I'm not even day drinking. Then.
You have to loosen the polar bear tie just a little. It cuts off circulation.
Can't breathe. Can't breathe. It's my home. New Mexico is where I was born and raised. I started my comedy career there. There's a huge gay and lesbian population, very supportive. And the comedy club that I started my career at a few years later, it just went out of business. It just went away. And so there was also that show that I started in the Fuzzy Lesbians for a change. Some of them were. And it went defunct. After a few years, they just stopped doing that as well. And I was like, wait a minute. There's a community here, and I know they will come to a comedy show.
Yeah.
So the first one I produced, it sold out a month before it even went. Everyone was just so excited. And over the last 8 years, it'll be 8 years this year, is our eighth year. Yeah, I think we've raised close to $25,000 for the AIDS Foundation, and we've had so many female headliners, from Michelle Ballin to Jessica Kirsten, Aaron Foley, Karen
wow.
Williams, Dana Eagle, all of these women, because women are so undersold in our community and our industry when it comes to headlining. For some reason, there's still that stigma that women aren't as funny.
Ridiculous.
It's harder for us to get headlining gigs around the country unless we're producing them ourselves or in more theaters.
Yeah.
So I made a decision to do that, and it's been phenomenal. Until last year, I was like, wait a minute. Why am I not being inclusive if I'm expecting everyone else to be? So I actually brought in Ian and Jason,
nice.
Two gentlemen I work with, and Aaron Foley, and it was one of the funniest shows we've ever done. I wish I had recorded it. And it's just been so successful. Everyone looks forward to it every year, and you know, it's in the same theater that I did that first set in front of 650
people. Wow.
It's a homecoming for me, Ken, so it just feels really nice to go back.
I love it. Well, folks need to get out there and check you out. As I mentioned, you will be performing at the Wall Street Nightclub in Columbus, Ohio on January 25th. So all my fellow Ohioans, you have to check out Dana Goldberg. Folks can stroll on over to danagoldberg.com to learn all about the fun things you're doing. Are there places that you're so excited to go to that are coming up?
Absolutely. I love going back to Pittsburgh and Columbus, and Portland and Seattle are right after that, and they are two of my favorite cities. Seattle right now has a special place in my heart. The last show I did there a month ago, it was one of those freak nights where I'm like, let's just record it. And the audience was so on, and I was so present, and everything lined up, and we cut a CD from it that's going to come out next week. So I cannot wait. It's called Crossing the Line, and it'll be available on my website. But because of that, like, I'm just so excited to go back. I still have this high from the show.
DanaGoldberg.com, everyone. This is one entertaining woman. I feel a kinship, Dana.
Oh, we're going to stay friends, Ken.
Okay. We will see you when you come to Ohio. Please keep doing what you're doing.
I cannot wait. Thanks so much, honey. Have a happy, wonderful New Year.
To you as well.
Bye, Ken.
That's it for this week's episode. Everybody, get out there and use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. And of course, while you're doing it, remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?